Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFVRL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest is Irina Lagunina, Associate Standards Editor and former Director and Special Projects Editor of the Russian Service here at RFVRL. Welcome, Irina, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting, Steve.
All right. It's great to have you on the program again. Now, as I mentioned in the preliminaries, August 24th marks 6 months since Russia launched a large-scale invasion of Ukraine. Thousands or tens of thousands of people have been killed. Millions have been forced to flee their homes. Cities and towns have been destroyed. And it's hard to see a way that the war could end in the near future. August 24th also happens to be Ukraine's Independence Day, the day on which, in 1991, Ukraine's parliament, with massive public support, adopted an independence declaration. And then on December 1st, 1991, Ukrainians overwhelmingly approved independence in a referendum, and the USSR ceased to exist later that month. The confluence of dates is a coincidence, but there's a direct link between the six-month mark in this stage of the war and Independence Day, because perhaps the main goal of Putin and Russia in the invasion is to deprive Ukraine of its independence. Irina, this date, August 24th, comes at what seems to be a particularly tense time. There's a lot of it's a very devastating war, so. There's more than just tension, but there is a lot of tension surrounding the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which is Europe's largest. There's tension over Russia's efforts to cement control over parts of Ukraine that it holds, including most of the Kherson region in the south and parts of the neighboring Zaporizhzhia region, which is home to that power plant. And there are also concerns that Russia could step up its attacks and broaden its targets, and particularly targeting Kyiv, ahead of and on Independence Day. Now, one other factor I'll mention is the death outside Moscow this Saturday of Darya Dugina, the daughter of ultranationalist Russian ideologue Alexander Dugin, in what Russian authorities say was a car bomb blast. And now they are saying they're blaming the FSB, the Federal Security Service, is blaming Ukraine. Kyiv has denied involvement, there's a lot of talk about it possibly that there could have been sort of an inside job in terms of Russian, that it was done within Russia with no involvement of any other country. But both Dugin and his daughter, Darya Dugina, have been vocal supporters of the war and have denigrated Ukraine. Dugin has called for its absorption to Russia for a long time, has been an avid supporter of the invasion, as was his daughter. Now, meanwhile, there's talk of kind of a deadlock in the fighting in the Donbass and in southern Ukraine. Now, I usually ask the guest two questions on this program, but today I'm going to make it three, by splitting the first question in two. Now, what I'd like to ask you, Irina, is whether you see the current stage in the war as a turning point, and whether Putin may be modifying his goals. After all, it's widely believed that he expected the Russian military to essentially force Ukraine to its knees and subjugate it within days of the invasion in February. But 6 months later, nothing of the kind has happened. Is Putin now prepared to settle for less?
You know, Steve, of course, it's very difficult to, speculate on what Putin's intentions are. But one interesting thing, one interesting development happened actually last week when Putin was opening the military fair, which is called Army 2022. And it was very kind of modest, I would say, appearance of Putin, because all he said was that the Russian soldiers bravely protect the freedom of Donbas area. That means Donetsk and Lugansk, so-called People's Republics. And this is quite a shift from the initial rhetoric that Putin used in February when he launched this aggression, where he actually was saying that where he denied Ukraine the right to exist. Of course, this new modest goals of the operation that he voiced during this very short 9-minute speech might reflect the real situation on the front line, where Russian troops could not manifest or show any really victorious movement into the Ukrainian territory. The Russian advances now are pretty modest, in spite of the heavy bombardment and heavy shelling of Ukrainian positions, and especially of Ukrainian cities and villages and the Ukrainian infrastructure. So Putin might be a little bit more modest in his assessment of the situation right now and the goals. But having said that, I have to repeat that initially his reaction was, his intention was to change power in Kyiv, to make Ukraine a part of Russia or maybe a satellite state. I would agree with the assessment of Ukrainian experts right now that any pause, that any break that Putin might get going to negotiations with Ukraine, for example, is temporary. So that was an interesting development. And I wouldn't want to speculate about Dugin and his daughter, even though I looked through the media today, and that was the topic of speculation of all sorts of Russian political spectrum experts, starting from the ultra-nationalists who now demand even more furiously the full elimination of Ukraine as a state, and the liberal part of Russia is actually very much afraid that this killing would force Kremlin to stage a bigger war in Ukraine. I think that both are wrong. Both sides are wrong in their assessments. And but really, I would not want to speculate on Dugin's daughter's death. Steve?
Yes, that makes sense. Absolutely. Apologies. I lost my connection for some time. Apologies if I was interrupting during that while you were speaking. And I understand. Of course, it's very murky, the situation surrounding Dugin's death. Now, usually, I just like to, move on, I guess, to my second question, which is much shorter and maybe simpler than the first one or two, or maybe not. Basically, 6 months, since the invasion of February 24th. What have these 6 months brought Russia?
Well, I wouldn't call it a simple question, because, you know, it's not really the fact that it's really, broad influence on the Russian society, on the Russian economy, on the Russian political situation in the world, but also because it's very difficult to assess because of the lack of true statistics in Russia. Let me give you one example of polls in Russia, for example. I think it was just brilliant. The state pollster Vtsiom made a poll among 1,600 Russians, asking them when they hear the word Russia, what do they think? What the word Russia symbolizes for them? So guess what? According to FTSOM, 7% of Russians replied that when they hear the word Russia, they see Putin as a symbol of Russia. And among the younger generation, 18 to 24, this percent is, it's 10% actually, which is absolutely understandable because, you know, Putin is in power for 22 years and they didn't see anybody else. So they say Putin. The superpower and the projection of power comes to mind to 6% of Russians, and the famous Russian bear got only 5%. So this is the official statistics. This is the official poster of Russian Federation. What do you want to know about the rest of the Russian statistics? Nonetheless, you know, there are some interesting facts of how the sanctions that apparently nobody predicted in Russia, how the sanctions affected Russia. And for example, last month in July, Russians got out of Russia $4.7 billion in June. This is maximum. This is a record number. And one of the factors that led to this record number is the flourishing of bank card tourism. Because Russians cannot use Visa and MasterCard in Russia. So they go to Kazakhstan, to Kyrgyzstan, to Yerevan. They open accounts there and take local bank cards. And of course, they open accounts there and move the currency, the foreign currency abroad. These are two phenomena that did not exist 6 months ago. Altogether, through this month, the foreign currency, the amount of foreign currency that Russians have on their private bank accounts shrink 20%. One fifth of what it was before the war. And this is, I think, striking. All this is circumstantial evidence, of course, how the sanctions affect Russian economy. But they really do. I know that there are experts even in the West who say that Russian economy is doing much better than they predicted after the beginning of the sanctions. But it's not going doing that great, that's for sure. One more thing that I can just tell as an example right now is, for example, the situation in the Russian exclave in Kaliningrad area. The economic situation is really bad because now this part of Russian territory mostly relies on the transfer of cargo through the sea. The line to get on the your shipment on the cargo ferry is now full till December. So, and a lot of you know, enterprises and production facilities just stopped because they don't have raw materials to continue working. So this is another example of how hard the sanctions actually hit the Russian economy. Overall, I looked through economic prognosis made by independent Russian economists. And for example, it's rather modest forecast that was given by the former economic advisor to Mikhail Gorbachev in 85-91. His name is Abel Agambegyan. He predicts that the real income of Russians by the end of the year will fall by 10%. Now, this is not critical to the extent that the whole country will be, you know, poor and miserable, but this is quite sufficient for people to feel the economic effect of the war, and to start thinking what they buy, how they buy, and how many times they can buy meat in the shop, for example. For many families, that will be the reality. Not even by the end of September or October, but by the end of the year, he thinks for sure. So this is the situation that Russians found themselves, and of course I need to mention the possibility of tourist visa ban for Russians, which I think provoked the most severe arguments in Russian liberal elite. Which at least that part of them that remained in Russia, because a lot of people left temporarily, of course, but they left. That also will have a severe impact on the society as well. Steve?
Thanks very much, Irina. I'll just focus a little bit on two of the things I think you said. One is sort of the polls and the kind of fixation or their dominance of Putin, and it's essentially kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, or maybe that's not the right word, right phrase, but a situation in which, people have Putin in their answers because he's the only one there. He's been in power for actually 23 years as prime minister or president now. I saw it when I was in Russia. You have people reporting on stories, speak to people, and they're complaining and criticizing the kind of standard of living, local authorities. But then, if it's an election coming up and you ask who they're voting for, sometimes it'll be, Putin, of course. And it's sort of like that answer that. It's kind of an assumption that this is the way it's going to be, even if you're unhappy with the situation. Now, the other thing I'd like to just focus on a little is, you mentioned sanctions hitting to some degree, and things will be getting worse in the winter, and the fact that kind of. There's no end in sight for either side. I think one of the Russian deputy foreign ministers said the other day, perhaps yesterday, that there's no chance of talks right now, and that does seem to be the case. So I think it seems like both Russia and the West, both Putin and Western leaders and Ukraine's leaders, feel that time may be on their side. Certainly that's the image that Russia is trying to project, the idea that they think that time is on their side. It's just as we go into this 6 months since the invasion, we go into this second half of a year since the invasion, not many signs that there could be some kind of an end in sight. We're getting a little short on time. I'll stop there, but you can take some questions if anyone has questions. Well, I'll just give it a few moments. All right, I guess I don't see any questions. Correct me if I'm wrong. But if not, we can wrap it up here. Irina, thanks very much. As usual, thanks very much for joining me and for your excellent insights.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for inviting.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Irina Logunina, Associate Standards Editor and former Director and Special Projects Editor of the Russian Service here at RFVRL. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFURL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFURL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, and other podcast platforms. I'll be back next Monday for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia, and please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, on Friday. Thanks for listening.